The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good morning, Glory America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway on Tuesday, June 8th. Here is the rundown. The swearing-in of the new Israeli government, led by Prime Minister-designate Naftali Bennett, will be on Sunday, absent any extraordinary circumstance. Sunday. Yesterday, the big news for millions and millions and millions of Americans and tens of millions worldwide is that the FDA has approved a new drug to slow the cognitive decline caused by Alzheimer's. This is the first drug that has been approved for treatment of Alzheimer's patients since 2003. That is a failure rate for many drugs that is unprecedented because the need is so great. The demand is so high. There is an explicit acknowledgement of the uncertainties of the effectiveness of the drug that the FDA did not grant the medication full approval. Instead, it cleared the drug, according to the Washington Post. Its brand name will be Aduhelm, A-D-U-H-E-L-M, based on its ability to reduce clumps, the amyloid beta in the brain. It ordered the drug maker's biotech giant Biogen to conduct a post-approval study to see what actually happens. They believe it is reasonably likely that it may help. One early diagnosis Alzheimer's patient said, "This is epic news." His name is Jeff Borgoff. "Now I may have time to watch my kids get married." My wife said, "I have more time with you now." Look, this is, I don't even think this was a hard decision. I'm so glad it turned out this way. If you've ever had anyone in your family develop and die of Alzheimer's, I've had my father-in-law was a victim of Alzheimer's. You want to try anything that doesn't hurt. And this doesn't hurt, and it might help. Easy decision. The FDA's got to get into that mindset. Financial Time. Alzheimer's drug from Biogen wins U.S. approval. Wall Street Journal. FDA approves first new Alzheimer's drug in nearly two decades. That was the big story yesterday, but there was another story hidden. Federal student loan loss forecast. So we're losing money. President Obama and then Vice President Biden insisted on taking over all student loans in college. They said we'd make money on it. This is back 10 years ago now. Well, the new loan loss forecast has risen by $53 billion as borrowers default, low repayment rates continue to decline. The government takes over anything, it gets worse. The Supreme Court yesterday ruled 9-0. 9-0. That immigrants who enter the country unlawfully, but who are granted a temporary stay for humanitarian reasons, do not become eligible to seek permanent residency. And that's not a matter of constitutional law, that's a matter of statutory law. It could be changed. But Justice Elena Kagan of the left wing of the court said the law was clear. It did not give anyone so entering the opportunity to apply for a green card. They are here unlawfully. They can receive amnesty if the Congress so decides, and eligibility if the Congress so decides, but they have no right to it. They can be deported at any time. I also have a Washington Post column today on the one case that will be dominating the next year, Dobbs. It's about abortion and what the Supreme Court ought to do. Bottom line, they ought to revoke Roe v. Wade and Casey. Planned Parenthood v. Casey, they ought to say, we're out of this business. We've tried for 49 years. There is no right to abortion in the Constitution. It is up to the state legislatures and governors to decide what to do, or the state constitutions, if they have been amended, to govern, because this is not a federal constitutional issue. I'll get back to that later. Andrew Cuomo is in trouble. Federal prosecutors have subpoenaed material related to his book. Federal prosecutors have asked for drafts of the recent memoir about the COVID-19 crisis. It came out in October 2020. And now prosecutors are interested in the nursing home issues in the book. What did Andrew Cuomo know? When did he know it? That's bad news for Andrew Cuomo. The feds recovered millions in ransomware payments from the Colonial Pipeline hackers, about half. The Russian hacker ring DarkSide has somehow been made to cough up about half of the money that was paid. There's an extraordinary story in the New York Times about Yale Law School and the assault on Amy Chow, I think I'm Chua, pronouncing it correctly, and what turns out to be investigatory gossip. She ought to have been left alone, but she became the object of ire of some students, and it has exposed bitter divisions in a top-drake institution struggling to adapt at a time of roiling social change. Students regularly attack their professors and one another for their scholarship, professional choices, and perceived political views. In a place awash in rumor and anonymous accusations, almost no one will speak on the record. Sounds lovely, doesn't it? Despite the pandemic, the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has reached historic levels. That represents an increase in the last month to 417 parts per million. That's the highest level of carbon dioxide since measurements began to be taken 63 years ago. That's, if climate change is a result of that and accelerates as a result of that, we're in for a rough climate change. We will have to adapt. And I don't think we're going to turn off the carbon dioxide emissions. It's not realistic. China will not do it. China and India account for most of the world's problem. They will not stop. They have to feed, clothe, house 1.3 billion people each. Terrible story out of Pakistan yesterday. 40 people died in a train crash. At least 40. They're still working on it. Tokyo has warned locals that they are a greater risk to each other from COVID than the visitors who are coming to the country for the Olympics. And that makes sense. The 100,000 athletes, trainers, officials, and reporters who have begun to arrive there, they're almost all vaccinated. So the Tokyo spike is going to happen whether or not they're there, and the exposure will occur. Well, I suppose they will gather for the games, and that does increase, sort of like the Black Lives Matter assemblies and demonstrations and the occasional riot last summer. Of course, that spread COVID. To get people together and they're not vaccinated, it will spread COVID. Big story in the Financial Times. Will Europe sign up to Joe Biden's plan to counter China? Well, you know, first you got to have a plan to counter China. I'm not sure we have a plan to counter China. Then a fun story, one smile at a time. William and Kate are showing up the wrathful Scottish National Party. That's in the Telegraph. Apparently, the royal family is committed to keeping the union together in Great Britain. And so Kate the Great and Prince William, the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, are doing all they can to make themselves popular in the Scottish countryside. They'll be spending more time at Balmoral. They'll be doing everything they can to make the Scots love them. And, you know, that's great. I think they should. Then my very favorite story of yesterday is from the Washington Post. A boy, his dog, and his Pokemon cards. A boy's dog, and he looks like Ralphie in A Christmas Story, 8-year-old Bryson Kleiman. He really does look like the kid in A Christmas Story, Ralphie. He has a little lab, 4-month-old puppy, who needed expensive medical treatment to survive, and his parents simply couldn't pay for it. It was way too expensive. So he took his Pokemon collection out. And instead of a lemonade stand, he loved his Pokemon. 8-year-old boys. I had two of those. They love their Pokemon, too. They just love their Pokemon. He has hundreds of cards. And he took them out, and he began to sell them by the side of the road. And his mom posted a picture of it. She was touched that he would give it up all for the dog. And guess what? Yes. Lots of people gave him both money and Pokemon cards. People are good. People are basically good. I want to know that you as well. I'll tell you more about it after the break. Someone out there yesterday gave $10,000 to Angel Tree. That sends 50 kids to camp. God bless you. I don't know who you are, but also, lots of you gave $200 and $400. I'll tell you about it after the break. The Angel Tree banner is at the top of HughHewitt.com. Please join the party. I think we're going to get 500 kids to camp. I think we're going to do that from this show. Stay tuned, America. Minutes after the hour, America. That music means David M. Drucker's in the house with the Washington Examiner. Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm great, Hugh. How are you?
I'm great. I have Tim Scott on for the first time in about a year. Senator Scott, of course, is running for re-election in South Carolina. I also think he's running for president. Has he declared one way or the other yet, David?
No, but I mean, he's running. I mean, if you talk to people in his orbit and talk to other Republican operatives that have been paying attention, he's planning to run. He's already said that his reelection to the Senate in 22, which, you know, I consider a shoo-in, will be his last. And I think he's going to run in 24. And these are preparations or thoughts that started surfacing at the very least last year, well before his convention speech, well before his State of the Union rebuttal or joint session rebuttal, that caught a lot of attention. So you can add him to the list. He'll run.
No, I think he's one of the top five, actually, and I believe he'll run regardless of whether former President Trump does. And I base that on that post-Joe Biden speech that he gave. But also, I met him originally more than a decade ago at the California Club when I could make contributions. When I went to work for the NBC and Washington Post of the world, you can't make contributions, but I gladly maxed out to him. Because he's got tremendous charisma. What do you think is his greatest strength? And I don't think it's race. I think it's a combination of background, which includes race, but just he represents a large swath of America that doesn't see themselves in politics except for him.
Yeah, you know, he comes to the table with a lot of natural ability. I too, usually refer to his sort of, he's very personable and he's got a natural stage presence. And if you've watched him on stage, you know, lately, I think people might be more familiar with his sort of formal teleprompter speeches, which he does quite well in delivering. But if he's off the cuff on stage, he's almost like a Sunday preacher. And he's sort of, his enthusiasm can be infectious. So he would have some very natural abilities. My read on running for president, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, is that if you aren't unmarried and have no children, it's going to hamstring you. You know, in the 19th century, we used to occasionally elect childless presidents, and there were a couple of bachelors, at least when they were elected. But we haven't done something like that in a long time. Being married, having kids, gives a way for voters to connect with you. And I think there's a reason why, and this is just my own theory, but I think there's a reason why it has been so long since we have seen a major nominee that was either unmarried or never had kids.
You know, there is an argument that there's an advantage in that, David, which is simply the ability to go 24/7 relentlessly. When you're Senator Cotton, you have two smalls. And when you are Mike Pompeo and you got a wife of many, many years and a son who's a young adult, I mean, they're just different family. It makes demands on you. And of course, Tim Scott has got his mom and his brothers, but it's sort of a liberating thing as well. I will be interested to see if you're right. It doesn't make a lick of difference to me that he's single.
He clearly doesn't make a lick of difference in South Carolina. They have bachelor childless senators of all states. And who knows, it may not matter, but you know, most of the candidates that run, it's like a family business. They're all in, and they do go balls to the wall. Regardless,
you can't say that. Okay, drop that. You can't say that, David Drucker, on the radio, my friend. So we had to delete that.
I apologize for that.
The FCC would just love it. Ajit Pai is no longer there to look the other way.
You know, how many years have I been doing this show, and I finally triggered the
Oh, don't worry about it. But it was the first time ever. And, that's why we are constantly on a watch when even the reliable David Drucker can slip. And That's okay. Oh, don't worry about it, David. You get three strikes and you're out. So you that's strike one.
So anyway,
I think it does allow him to go 100% maximum effort so people can understand what you said.
Yeah, basically people get the gist. The point I was trying to make is that most candidates do it anyway. But you're right about this. And we saw it with Marco Rubio in 2016. And look, it was the same thing for Ted Cruz. But candidates, the sacrifices, I don't want to put it on the same plane as the sacrifices that military families make. But let me be clear about that. But if you have a spouse, if there is a mother or father in elected office in the U.S. Senate, in the House, you're gone 5 days a week, and somebody's holding down the fort. And if you're running for president, you're gone 7 days a week. You know, Rubio used to rush back on Sundays to be with his kids 1 day a week. And he was trying to help them with their math homework while he was on the road, from the car or the plane or whatever he was doing. It's a very difficult thing to do because voters, just the competition demands a 24/7.
Yeah, I've never run for anything, and I've told everyone, I'm never running for anything. I got a family, and I just don't know how to do it. To everyone, it's not military sacrifice. Nobody's in danger when they're campaigning, but it is a sacrifice to be away. And I appreciate elected officials who go to those meetings all night long and serve overnight and campaign, because it is a sacrifice, and the Republic depends upon it. Good point, David Drucker. Great point. Talk to you soon. David M. Drucker on Twitter. I'll be right back. Byron York, his colleague, is next. It's Tuesday on the Hugh Hewitt Show. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific. They lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Morning, glory, America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for listening to the Hugh Hewitt Show. I'm joined by Byron York of the Washington Examiner. Good morning, Byron. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. Doing well, thanks.
Now, I have Senator Tim Scott on later today. It's the first time I've talked to Tim in about a year, and I am curious what your estimate of his chances to become president is.
My estimate of his chances to become president? I would say that if you look at, you mean ultimately or in 2024?
2024.
Let's say that. Okay. If you look at the field right now, I would say he is not one of the leading candidates. Ron DeSantis is clearly pretty far ahead in Republican sentiments, provided President Trump does not run. And the thing that's interesting to me about DeSantis is I think back to 2015 and Governor Scott Walker. And if you remember, there was an event in Iowa, a big cattle call of all the Republican candidates. Representative Steve King organized it. Trump was there. I mean, everybody was there. And the big star who emerged as the front runner in the race was Scott Walker, because if you remember, Scott Walker had passed these reform bills in Wisconsin, and had stood up to the worst that the left could throw at him. They did everything they could to try to kill him, and it didn't work. So he was really much admired in Republican circles. And then basically he imploded. The whole campaign just kind of imploded because he really wasn't up to being a national candidate. So Republicans do get excited about candidates for a while, and then things change. Could that happen with DeSantis? Possible, although he's clearly much more prepared for a national campaign than Walker was. So where does Scott fit in all this? I think he fits in that group of Republicans like Tom Cotton or Josh Hawley. They're members of the Senate. Remember, it used to be a law of nature that senators don't become president. That's no longer true. But I think he fits in that group that's probably polling in the 1% or less than 1% range right now.
Now, I believe that there are five. This is, again, if the former president does not run, I put Tom Cotton, Mike Pompeo, Ron DeSantis, Chris Christie, and Tim Scott in that top tier of people who, because of the bumper car nature of politics, could easily be on the track or off the track because of the Scott Walker experience. And I always point to that because Scott Walker, I remember being on Meet the Press and saying, Scott Walker won the weekend. I mean, he's, you know, he's way ahead. And then you're right, the wheels came off. And so you really can't tell what's going to happen. And you really can't tell opposition. You can't really tell fundraising. You can't really tell who can actually run the campaign and not spend all the money like Tim Pawlenty's campaign did. Remember, he had all the money and he spent all the money and there was no money left.
He didn't make it past the Ames straw poll, I believe.
Right. And so I always wonder why anyone spends a dime on anything until the first debate. But the key part of the 2016 cycle were the debates. And it turns out Ronna McDaniel tells me on the air that they have rules by 2022 in order to govern 2024 by the standing bylaws of the Republican committee. So they're actually developing those debate rules right now. I think they are the most important thing the RNC decides on. Byron, what do you think?
Well, I think you're probably right. And the thing that matters, the one thing you really didn't mention, although it was kind of implicit in what you said, is how the candidate performs. How good is he? And I remember going to Arkansas in 2014. That's when Tom Cotton, who had been a member of the House, was running for the Senate. He was running against Mark Pryor, the Democrat with a big family name in Arkansas, who was clearly out of gas. So Cotton was running, and he was clearly working on being a good candidate. It's not something I thought that was natural to him. This is my observations of him. And it was something that he was working on, all of the glad handing and posing with kids and all of the everything that you do as a candidate. And who's going to be good at that? We won't really see. My guess is that Tim Scott would actually be quite good at it. He and Trey Gowdy and Nikki Haley, campaigned a lot for Marco Rubio in the final days of the South Carolina race in 2016. Obviously, Rubio didn't win, but they were a pretty dynamic bunch, and Scott was certainly among them. My guess is he'll be good at that retail politics on a national scale, but you have to wait and see if it really is true.
Now, Byron, one of the ideas I am urging on people is that the RNC organize smaller groups of the presidential candidates to go out and hold town halls and then invite the networks for town halls, by the way, moderated by the Byron Yorks and the Hugh Hewitts of the world, by people who ask questions that are actually of interest to Republican audiences, not, you know, remember George Stephanopoulos asking about making contraception illegal? I mean,
I second that, yes.
Yeah. I mean, there's Mary Catherine Hamm, there's Guy Benson, there's Ben Shapiro. There are literally scores of people that could ask questions that will be of interest. Riveting television, by the way. The ratings would be extraordinarily high. They can't start presidential debates, but they can start doing that. Do you think that the would-be candidates would be cooperative? Would Pompeo go out with Rubio and go out with Nikki Haley and talk about national security, for example?
Certainly, if the party wanted them to, I think they would look kind of churlish not to do it. I think it's a good idea. There's some sort of precedent in that when the Republicans had such a huge field. What was it? 20 plus candidates, and the networks had to come up with a tier system to divide the field into two nights for debates. And so, I mean, there's precedent of having a group that's not the entire field meet. Taking that a step further and making it smaller groups in debates devoted to particular subjects seems to me to be a good idea. We've seen that occasionally in the primaries where a couple of candidates would decide to appear. Mike Huckabee did that, I think, in one of his races. But I think the more exposure, the better. And they would view it that way, too. I think it would look bad if they said no.
And it would help the party a great. I mean, Win Red would definitely benefit. And they could do it around themes, global warming. They could do national security. They could do Taiwan. But they've got to get organized earlier because television drives these things. Your ability to appear on and persuade via the small screen is the essence. And then, of course, the backroom online campaign matters a great deal, too. And so back to my big five, what distinguished Donald Trump, and I saw it in the first debate I moderated in 2016, I did for him, He's a brilliant television performer. He just had skill sets that no one else on the stage had. We thought Chris Christie had him. He was pretty good. And we thought Rubio had him. He was pretty good. But Trump stayed on his mark and dominated those, Byron. So who of this group of five, do we know DeSantis has that? I know Tim Scott's got some of it. I know that Cotton stays on his mark. I've seen Pompeo on the Nixon seminar now. Who do you think has got that ability to dominate a stage?
Well, they're all good in that old conventional pre-Trump way. I mean, everybody you pointed to did well. Marco Rubio is a polished performer. I watched him at event after event, does well. But Trump was something entirely different. And I was thinking, as you were asking me this question, here we are talking about this race as if it's 2008 or 2012, and the Republicans are going through the conventional process to find a candidate, when really the elephant in the room, as we know, is what is Trump going to do and how will that affect this whole process? I do think that everybody views Trump as just this unique figure. And while his positions, his career influences Republican positions, nobody's going to come out and perform like Trump because they're just not him and it would look silly.
100% agree. And I also don't believe if he gets in that it will be dispositive on what the others do. I think at least two or three of these people are going to run regardless. Chris Christie has told me that on air. He's going to go run regardless.
I agree with that.
And so there are some people that will go anyway, but it will have an enormous impact on the field, just not a dispositive impact on the field as to who gets in and who doesn't get in. Now, last question, Byron, when the RNC sits down to do this, should they exclude the networks from any role other than open carry? I mean, that just make the events open to all the networks.
Yeah. I think it would be a good idea. I think that the one of the lessons from the Trump experience is to break out of the older ways of doing things. And I agree that moment, it was in New Hampshire in 2012, the New Hampshire debate, when George Stephanopoulos just out of nowhere comes up with a question about contraception from Mitt Romney. Romney said, hey, just leave it alone. They need to get past that.
They need to break free. They need to absolutely get out of that. And by the way, they'll have to come covered anyway. Byron York, always a pleasure. Follow him at Byron York online and at the Washington Examiner on Fox. I'll be right back, America.
Beyond the sea, somewhere.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. That music means Admiral Stav is in the house. Admiral James Stav Reedy is retired United States Navy, now the chairman of the Rockefeller Foundation. He's also a member of the Carlyle Group and the author of 2034, along with Elliot Ackerman, the New York Times bestselling book. Admiral, I had dinner last night with David Trulio, who was John Rood's deputy over at the at Pentagon for a number of years. 43 appointee as well with Raytheon Boeing. He's now in a different business. And he read 2034 and loved it. I'm wondering, are people still buying it left, right, and center?
Yeah, it really is hanging in there longer than my previous nine books in terms of being up in pretty high airspace. So we're very happy with it. And I think I mentioned to you, we've signed a two-book sequel deal with Penguin. So this is a project that is going to continue going forward. As I always say about the book, let's hope it stays on the fiction list and doesn't drift over toward the nonfiction side of things.
Well, that's what I want to talk to you about today. But before I do, I also want to know if you are back on the road for Washington Speakers Bureau. The Admiral and I share a Speakers Bureau, and I have told them I'm open to going again. Are you back on the road yet?
I am. And I have my very first in-person speech in Orlando, Florida, for the American Power Association in about 10 days. So,
good on you. Good on you. Now, let's go to the subject of 2034, because I am going to discuss it with a couple of senators this morning. I discussed it yesterday with Congressman Gallagher, which is, what will the United States do if the People's Liberation Army Navy begins to assemble a flotilla that is clearly intended to invade, or if the People's Liberation Army Air Force begins dropping paratroopers. I know there are war games. Congressman Gallagher complains that he doesn't get to go to any of them. What do you think we'll do?
I think at this point, if that scenario unfolded immediately in front of us, I think we would rush assistance to Taiwan. We would move a couple of carrier battle groups forward. We would put new air defense units in place. We would open up all of our ammunition capability, logistics support. I think we would do everything we could to make it as tough as possible on China if they decided to follow through. Simultaneously, we would be saying to China, if you do this, if you attack and destroy this democracy, there will be significant economic consequences for you. We would also be marshaling our allies, partners, and friends, get as many of them with us. I think we'd do everything short of attacking China, and then we would see if China would blink. That's how I think it would unfold in the immediate future.
Now, yesterday I had Jonah Goldberg on my podcast, The Interview with Hugh Hewitt, and Jonah has an article out called The Kowtow to China, talking about American sports, entertainment, especially the movies, and how it is all obsequious now for fear of upsetting the Chinese market. And Jonah's estimate of President Xi is that if he can get away with it, he does it. So he can get away with repressing Hong Kong, so he did it. He can put the Uyghurs in the concentration camp, so he did it. He can dispossess the Tibetan people, so he does it. If he thinks he can get away with Taiwan by acting with a clarity, I mean, rapid speed, and I imagine that paratroops can be there in, what, 30 minutes?
Very quickly. I'll give you the scenario that I think is more likely than an overt massive invasion. It would be a special forces lightning grab. And frankly, I think there are probably already, unfortunately, sufficient sleeper cell special forces inside Taiwan who have been placed there maybe decades ago, but certainly over the last decade or so. And I think they are capable of linking up and taking control of key air nodes. So I think the PRC would probably be able to just fly in cadres. Would there be paratroopers? Possibly. I think more likely is a massive cyber attack that blinds the system, locks down the command and control, targeted assassinations of key leaders, a takeover of the airports, and then the airplanes come flying in with the cadres to take over. Now, since Admiral Jim Stavridis can see that scenario, I suspect the Taiwanese, I don't suspect, I know the Taiwanese are very cognizant of it. They are doing all the things you would do to prepare for that, as well as the more conventional scenario we tend to think of. But at the end of the day, Hugh, I don't think this is going to look like D-Day, you know, June 6th, when a massive wave of Allied troops hit the continent. I think it'll be much more 21st century.
So let's play out both scenarios, Admiral, because I'm trying to get people to focus on the Situation Room and the immediate aftermath of the recognition that a hostile takeover is underway, whether it is large or small, little green men, or lots of PLA ships setting sail. Let's go with your scenario. If those airplanes are bringing in the cadres, do American F-22s shoot them down? I mean, that'll be the question. President Biden turns to Jake Sullivan and to Secretary Austin and to Secretary Blinken and says, what do I do? What do you think they tell him to do?
Well, first and foremost, I don't think at this minute we should be in the business of, if you will, setting a red line or walking away from what has been our policy for several decades, which is called strategic ambiguity. As you know, this is a deliberate a policy choice which says to China, we may shoot them down or we may not. You've got to factor that uncertainty into your calculus. Now, in today's world, when we see a growing Chinese Belt and Road Initiative, growing Chinese adventurism around the world, growing, your point, willingness to take what they can get away with, I think that that policy of strategic ambiguity is starting to decline. and I see increasingly responsible commentators who are saying, time to rethink that, draw closer to Taiwan. So that's a long way of saying, I hope we don't hit that point. If I'm Jake Sullivan in 2021 and there are plane loads of Chinese troops headed in, I do not shoot them down. I do the other things that I just mentioned, reinforce Taiwan, move carriers forward, keep some ambiguity, some questioning in the back of the Chinese mind, use our own offensive cyber tools intelligently, blind China in space. I mean, there are a number of tools we can take before we start direct attacks that kill Chinese military personnel. That's big casino if we take that step. There's a lot we can do before that, and that's what I would be advising the president to do.
Admiral, if we don't do it, they'll never give it back, right? And if those cadres land, and I don't know how long it takes. I don't know anything about the logistics of this. Zero. Big double zero. Hugh Hewitt knows nothing about it. But tell me how many troops they can get there in 2 hours, and assuming that they have the airplanes. I hadn't thought about that. That obviously makes sense. And there are skirmishes on the ground because Taiwan is not an ineffectual power. How long does it take to do that? Because if they don't think we're going to do anything, they'll never give it back, right?
I think it's a very similar situation to Ukraine, where you saw Russia invade and take Crimea. They will never give it back. And I agree with your assessment. Once China is in control of Taiwan, it is lost forever. And that is because China views it not as a thriving, independent democracy, but rather as a renegade province, as they often refer to it. So it will not come back. So, yeah, it's a decision. And hopefully we can control that ladder of escalation and get China to make the calculus that it's not worth doing this right now. And frankly, that, in my view, is what is, in fact, deterring them. And it is all the things I mentioned, short of plunging these two nations into a war that would be bloody, terrible, and potentially catastrophic because of the potential use of strategic nuclear weapons. And so back to the book, 2034, part of the cautionary tale, in that case, of course, it's a South China Sea scenario that opens it. It could just as easily, frankly, be a Taiwan scenario that had opened the book. It was just a choice. I felt the South China Sea was more likely, and it's also where you have military-to-military contact between U.S. and PLAN assets day after day after day. In any event, the message of 2034 is it's hard to control the ladder of escalation once there's blood in the water.
Now, and I'm going back to, because I'm thinking about this in a new way because of your proposal that they get the airports. If we don't shoot them down, they'll never give it back. The dominoes fall, including Japan is just immediately in strategic dire straits, to borrow a naval term. What could we do now? Because everyone's hoping we have time and we can interpose the Sixth Fleet. Well, you've just given us a scenario where we don't have time and the Sixth Fleet can't get there and you can't interpose yourself and have a Cuban Missile Crisis. What should we do right now? We got about a minute, Admiral. Do we put troops in Taiwan? We got three senators going and the Chinese are pulling out their hair.
I think we do many of the things I mentioned a moment ago. More high-level visits, training and exercises. No permanently stationed troops, but rotating units, Seventh Fleet ship visits, ongoing mutual shared intelligence and information, cyber work together. We draw closer to Taiwan. Simultaneously, we're talking to our allies, partners, and friends in the region. And by the way, if China were to attack Japan or a territory of Japan, say the Senkaku Islands in the East China Sea, that is a red line. We would go to war. The last three presidents have all said so. Taiwan is different. We ought to go as close as we can, in my view, at this moment, without making a strategic commitment.
Admiral, with a minute. First, excuse my error for saying six. It's the Seventh Fleet, and I should know that. But if we don't go for Taiwan, why would we go for Japan?
because Japan is a treaty ally. We have a sworn defense pact, mutual defense. An attack on one of us will be regarded as an attack on both. We have no such agreement with Taiwan at this moment.
Should we get one?
I would say it's premature to do that. I think moving in that direction, formalizing it, would cause China perhaps to miscalculate and undertake an invasion now. Again, there's a lot we can do short of declaring a red line, calling for Taiwanese independence, or signing an assured treaty. We're not there yet. If China's behavior continues, then that is a course of action that should be considered as we go forward in time.
Admiral, always interesting. It's the key strategic question. Do you agree with me on that?
I think it is the most likely key that unlocks a global war, and therefore it deserves all of our attention.
Admiral, always a pleasure. Glad you're back on the road. Congrats. People should read 2034. It's like a primer on what we've been talking about, but it's readable and it's so exciting. Congratulations, Admiral. Thank you again. Let me remind everyone, relieffactor.com, relieffactor.com. I took it in the first hour and I remind you about it two more times. Why? Because I want you to enjoy middle age and early late age and late, late age. And even if you're an athlete and you're young, and you just are working out to the max and you're doing the bench presses, if you're at the Browns Super Bowl bound training camp in Berea, you need relieffactor.com. They should have bowls of Relief Factor. There are rumors that in the old days they used to have bowls of little red and green pills. Now they ought to have just bowls of relieffactor.com in every NFL training room. And you ought to have it in your car. So if you forget it in the kitchen, it's in your car. Don't go anywhere. I'm coming right back. America, it's the Hugh Hewitt Show. Morning, glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined by United States Senator Tom Cotton. Good morning, Senator. Great to have you back.
Good morning, Hugh. Good to be back with you.
I had Admiral Stavridis on last hour, and we were talking about Taiwan. Taiwan was on the cover of The Economist on May 1, called the most dangerous place in the world. And I've been asking people, I asked Jonah Goldberg yesterday, it's posted over at the interview with Hugh Hewitt, what would the United States do if the People's Liberation Army launch ships at Taiwan, or even worse, airplanes full of paratroops. And the admiral corrected me. He said, no, they've got cadres on the island. They would seize the airports and the PLA would just land there. What would we do, Senator Cotton? What would you advise the president to do if that operation actually began to unfold?
Well, Hugh, the answer is very simple. What we should do is come to Taiwan's aid. And to be even more specific, we should tell China now that we'll come to Taiwan's aid. The best way to deter that scenario is to make it crystal clear to Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party that we will not tolerate an invasion and forced annexation of Taiwan to mainland China. For decades, Hugh, as you know, our policy was one of so-called strategic ambiguity. We weren't clear what we would do, but circumstances have changed. Back then, the People's Liberation Army probably wasn't capable of executing that operation, and Taiwan was not yet a full democracy. Today, however, I think most observers agree the PLA could execute an invasion, and Taiwan is a very vibrant democracy. So I think it's best that we be very clear about our strategic intentions here as a way to preserve the peace across the Taiwan Strait.
Now, I believe it was Dean Acheson who left there too much ambiguity with regards to the Korean Peninsula, and Stalin misjudged it. I believe it was Acheson. So when the admiral said to me that if, in fact, they executed the quick strike, airplanes landing at Taiwan airports or near fields, and maybe paratroopers and special forces, that the United States should not shoot down those planes with F-22s based in Japan, I was a little bit surprised. Should we, if that were to unfold? That's the wrap. That's the least amount of time. That's decide within an hour sort of stuff. Should we shoot down their transports?
Hugh, we should take whatever steps are necessary to preserve the status quo across the Taiwan Strait and the autonomy of Taiwan. It would be a disaster of historic proportions to stand by while the Chinese Communist Party annexed Taiwan, not just a critical island outpost that allows China to project power around the world, not just a commitment the United States is widely perceived to have made for decades, but also the world's single largest producer of semiconductors, essential in a modern economy. To let China simply take Taiwan while standing idly by would be a disaster of historic proportions. That's why we should be crystal clear up front that we will not tolerate it, and we should be engaged in a crash armament course with Taiwan to ensure they have what they need to forestall that invasion for as long as possible should Xi Jinping decide to go for the jugular.
Now, the Admiral said we've got a mutual defense treaty with Japan. We don't have one with Taiwan, and that would have to precede our actually getting involved, or he recommended it. Should we execute that treaty, Senator?
We do have that defense treaty with Japan. We have never had a treaty with Taiwan. We have committed only to ensuring Taiwanese autonomy and to preserving the peaceful status quo, so there cannot be any forcible annexation of Taiwan to the mainland. So I think more important than a formal treaty is a clear commitment to what has always been U.S. policy. To make that commitment up front, therefore, China knows exactly what it's bargaining for if Xi Jinping ever decides to try to invade Taiwan.
Now, would the occupation of Taiwan or the takeover of Taiwan be reversible? In other words, if doves say, don't worry, we'll talk them out of it later. We have sanctions. We can crush China's economy. My theory is if they ever take the island, they'll never give it back. It's just done. It'll be like Crimea under Obama. It's never coming back. What do you think?
Generally, when dictators seize territory, especially territory of which their nation has had irredentist claims for decades, they don't go sit down the United Nations and talk it out and then decide, okay, you guys were right. We shouldn't have done that in the first place. So, no, if the Chinese Communist Party seizes Taiwan, I think that's the end of Taiwanese autonomy. And it's a huge, huge victory of historic proportion for the Chinese Communist Party, something that we cannot allow to happen.
Why does it represent such a strategic gain for the People's Republic of China and the Chinese Communist Party and such a loss for the West?
There are a few reasons, Hugh. First is that we are seen as the guarantor of the peaceful status quo across the Taiwanese Strait. And if we were to stand by while the Chinese Communist Party annexed Taiwan, it would cause grave concern for all of our allies, to include treaty allies like Japan or NATO allies around the world, who would begin to make their own accommodations with China or with Russia or with Iran or so forth. Second, Taiwan sits in the middle of the so-called first island chain. Think about Japan, Taiwan, the Philippines, things that keep China's Navy largely bottled up or give us strategic choke points should there ever be military conflict. If they take Taiwan, they can easily project naval power into the Pacific and therefore around the world. And as I said, Taiwan produces more than 4 out of every 5 advanced semiconductors in the world. Look at how many American jobs are being lost or at least furloughed right now because of a shortage of semiconductors. To let the Chinese Communist Party seize that manufacturing capacity would give them a chokehold on the American economy and American jobs, much like when Germany remilitarized the Rhineland and seized so much fertile industrial territory.
So, Senator, I've never been to Taiwan. I have no idea. I don't even have a picture in my mind. Maybe I should go and broadcast there for a week or something like that and tour around and see. But do the Taiwanese, the Republic of Taiwan, have capacity for self-defense for the first wave? Can they take the airports back if Cadre sees it? Do they have intelligence services? Have they got submarines?
Well, I mean, I think in the end, Hugh, common sense just says that an island of 25 million people is not going to be able to permanently fight off the People's Liberation Army with 1.3 billion people behind it. The important, the most important part of the defense of Taiwan, though, is adding hours and then adding days to the amount of time it would take the PLA to pacify the island. Now, Admiral Stav is right that the Chinese communists have the island infiltrated. It would not look like the D-Day invasion from the very beginning. It would look more like probably Crimea. There would be subterfuge, deception, agent provocateurs, creating provocations to allow further military attack. So it would be in the gray zone of conflict initially. Taiwan has the ability to a degree to resist that, to try to fight back. They can slow down the invasion to some extent, They're probably better at that than they were 5 or 10 years ago because of the arms sales to Taiwan over the last 4 years. However, we need to accelerate that. We need to work with them closely to make sure that their cyber defenses are hardened, that their defenses against those kind of Chinese agents are improved. And ultimately, like I said, they can add time in hours and then in days to the length of time it would take the PLA to pacify the island. That allows the cavalry to arrive.
Now, Senator, the Chinese are objecting, the Chinese communists are objecting loudly to the visit by three senators that is planned to Taiwan. I don't know who the senators are. Maybe it's you. And that objection tells me 100 senators should go there. Do you know who's going and why?
I don't. I'm glad they are going. I'll find out who they are today now that I'm aware of it. But look, I mean, Hugh, I've been to Taiwan. I think China objected to it then. Taiwan frequently hosts senators, members of Congress. They host delegations from state legislatures as well. They host governors. They host business leaders. They do all of that because the United States government executive branch officials tend not to send personnel to the island because of the longstanding understandings about the relationship between mainland China and Taiwan. But it's a longstanding practice for legislators, both in the United States Congress and in state legislatures, to travel to Taiwan. I think they even host members of the media, so you should go, Hugh.
I should. My very last question on this, given the rapidity and frequency of the Chinese incursions, the People's Liberation Army Air Forces entering into Taiwan airspace almost daily now, that changes the facts on the ground. It's sort of dress rehearsal for what may be coming. Ought we to have regularly rotating American troops going into Taiwan for a little? I mean, you can call it training. You don't have to call it basing. You can just have them there and move them on like we used to do with Poland. Now they're permanently there, I think. We got a minute. What do you think the Pentagon should be doing in this regard?
Hugh, I've long said that we should have uniformed officers, to include flag officers, generals and admirals visiting Taiwan. That's something that administrations of both parties have refrained from doing. I think it's wholly appropriate. It's consistent with our understandings with both the Chinese Communist Party on mainland China and with Taiwan's government. You could reduce or lower that down the ranks as well to have more broad-based personnel in and out. Look, we have American personnel at the American Institute, which is kind of our quasi-embassy in Taipei. As you say, the incursions that the PLA Air Force makes in the Taiwanese airspace is a way to reduce warning time and make it harder for us to anticipate, for Taiwan to anticipate, if China is going for the jugular.
Senator Cotton, always bracing. Thank you, Senator. I'll be right back. America, stay tuned.